This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
It's pronounced Suleimani or Suli. The people who live there call it Suli.
Yeah. And it's a university there, right?
Right. I'm teaching at the American University of Iraq-Suleimania, which implies that there will be other branches someday. That's the goal of the founder.
Yeah.
And it is 3 years old. This year coming up is our third year. So it was founded in 06-07 and then... No, 07-08, and then last year I was there for the second year, and this year coming up is the third year.
Well, we want to hear all about this and the university and, you know, why someone here in Charlottesville would, you know, somebody working on the downtown mall would go to work in Iraq. I mean, this is just an amazing story, and you and I have talked about this before, that you have so many fascinating stories about what life is really like there, but... Start us off first, Roz, with just your background and you know, Roslyn 101.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was working, as you say, at The Hook, but before that I had been teaching. I taught for about 15 years at Hampton Sydney down in Farmville. And I taught, then I left and went out to California and taught at UC Santa Cruz for a couple of years. And then I was missing everybody here, especially my children. So I came back and I was working at The Hook and doing some editing for the Miller Center, on the presidential oral histories.
And you just, also do something with the SATs, don't you?
Oh, I just do that 1 week in the summer. Yeah. Actually 10 days each summer I go down. It's been in Daytona. I grade the AP exams for ETS. Yeah,
oh, wow.
And that's a big job. They have 400, 500 readers every summer reading those exams.
Yeah.
Now moving now to Kansas City after 7 years in Daytona, so it's not going to be so appealing. But yeah, I was doing that, but that was just once a year.
Yeah.
But I got a call in the spring, late winter of 2008, I guess, and... 2008, and from a friend of mine who I actually had taught with at Hampton Sydney, and the provost of AUI, we call it AUIS, American University of Iraq Suleimania, that's abbreviated AUIS, and it's online. The website is AUIS.org. People can read about it.
AUIS.
American University in Iraq-Suleimania, so
got
it's
it.
AUIS.org. And the provost at that time was a man named John Agresto, who had been the president of the University of St. John's University in Santa Fe. There's one in Annapolis, and he was the president of the one in Santa Fe. And he had gone over with the provisional authority when the troops went into Iraq in, I think, 03, as Bush government representative to try and restore the educational system in Iraq. And they weren't able to do it for various reasons, and he wrote a book of kind of a mildly famous book called Mugged by Reality, where he talked about how they did things wrong and how they mistook what was going on there and how they failed to do what they went to accomplish. And in the course of being involved with the education there, he came to the attention of a man, a Kurdish man, a politician named Barham Saleh. And he is Western educated. He went to has a PhD from MIT. He reminds me of the Thomas Jefferson you described earlier, because he is a Kurd, but he is right now the deputy prime minister of Iraq. So he's a high-ranking politician. But he has a dream that he wants to leave an educational system intact for the future of the free democratic Iraq.
An educational system like Jefferson dreamed,
exactly,
that would create future leaders.
Exactly.
People who would get involved in government,
exactly,
and participate.
And a participatory democratic government. Exactly
right.
That's his dream. And so he single-handedly, really, with a lot of money from contributors, but a lot of his own money, some money also from the State Department, founded this university, the American University in Iraq. And he dreams that there will be one in Baghdad and one in Basra and one in Nineveh. I mean, he really imagines and envisions this becoming as famous and as successful as the American University in Beirut and the American University in Cairo. There's one also, a new one in Kurdistan, the American University, in Kuwait. And now there's one in Afghanistan. They're recruiting people to come and work at the American University in Afghanistan, which is even a little far out there for me.
Even for me,
I'm not going to Afghanistan. I don't know what luck they'll have recruiting people.
We're talking with Roslyn Warfield Brown of Charlottesville, and she has a job in northern Iraq, and we're going to hear more details about her work in northern Iraq. And Roz, you'll tell us what life is really like there.
Mm-hmm.
And how far is it from Baghdad, by the way?
I flew to Baghdad in about 40 minutes.
So it's very close.
Yeah, very close, yeah.
So let's take a break here for local news and weather and continue this conversation on the other side with Roslyn Warfield Brown. You're listening to Charlottesville Right Now. ...of Appalachia. Let's rejoin our conversation with Rosalind Warfield Brown of Charlottesville, working in Iraq. So, Roz, you found out about this job at this brand new university in northern Iraq. Did you instantly think, "Oh man, I could do this," or were you like most people thinking, "Oh my gosh, I'm not going to Iraq. I'm not a soldier."
No, I instantly thought I'm there. In
really?
Fact, I got the email and said, "Would you be interested in going?" And I absolutely typed back, "I'm there. Just tell me the details."
Wow.
Because I was at a place where I thought I needed a change. I needed an adventure, and they called me. I talked to the provost and the chancellor on the phone, and they offered me the job. And I told them that I really couldn't take the job without seeing the place, because I was, you know, in a sense, burning all my bridges here. I don't have tenure anywhere. There wasn't something cushy to come back to. So they took me over, brought me over in March. I saw the place and I met some of the students and it was the first year. So it was a really skeleton crew of staff. I didn't meet very many of the people I now work with, but I saw enough of it to know that it wasn't scary. It isn't dangerous. Kurdistan is very safe. It's guarded by a group of soldiers called Peshmerga, who are the mountain fighters from the days when Kurdistan was, first of all, had a civil war and then was fighting Saddam. And so they have checkpoints everywhere. Everything is guarded by soldiers with guns. I felt, and there's never been an incident there that has threatened anybody foreign. I mean,
yeah.
There was one incident in Sulaymaniyah about 3 years ago, but it was after a local politician. And so I felt assured that it was safe, and I liked it. It's not an aesthetically appealing place.
What's it look like? I mean,
well, it's everything is stucco or cement house, and houses are all gray and brown. Actually, they are the color of Necco wafers. You know those that little roll.
I do.
There?
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
All the, if you remember what they look like, that's what
with
the colors
peanut butter
are
filling. Yeah.
Well, they are all sort of tan and light pink, and in fact, the architecture is worth paying attention to, because it's kind of a mix between Miami Beach Art Deco, some of the more elaborate garish things, and then just Stone Age just hovels.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting place in that regard, but I mean, just from the fact that it's so different, but it aesthetically everything is brown, gray, beige. I mean, that the people dress in black. The ladies, of course, the women wear the long black abayas, most of them.
Abaya, which is
a long black gown or robe that they put over their regular clothes, and
okay.
They're open in the front. It's like when they run down the street or walk down the street with the wind, it looks like big bats or big
yeah.
crows with these big things flapping out. And a lot of the young women are covered. The Arab students are covered. They wear the scarves. No one has a face covered. I've never seen a burqa in Iraq.
So the burqa is the thing that covers the face.
Yeah, with a little fly swatter, net thing there in front.
Yeah.
And they wear those in Iraq. I mean, excuse me, in Iran and in Saudi. In fact, they have to wear them in Saudi Arabia. But I've seen them in the airport in Dubai. I've seen Iranian women and Saudi women with
them.
And
that comes out of the Quran, that there's something about women being covered?
Right, apparently so, yeah.
And I also think it's in the Old Testament. I mean, it's...
I don't know. It's actually, I went to Baghdad for a week to visit a student's family just at the end of school, and I had to be covered there, not my face, but I had to be covered the whole time with a scarf and a long, what they call a juba, a button-up dress with long sleeves. And I found it actually freeing instead of restricting. I mean, people say to me, "I hate it. It's subjugation of women and it's horrible." But actually, it was, you don't have to think about what you're going to wear. You just put that thing on and out you go. So actually, I only did it for a week. But I do have, you asked me about any funny stories, and I can tell you a funny story about that week in Baghdad.
Sure, sure. Was it scary when you flew?
Well, that's what everybody said. I had a hard time getting a visa. You have to have a visa to go into Baghdad unless you're going on military or government work. And I was just going for a visit. And that was very suspect. They couldn't understand why anybody would want to be going for a visit. So I had to go to the Soleimani airport and be interviewed and get a visa in my passport to go into Baghdad.
And you said, "I'm just here working at the university and I want to see Baghdad."
Right. And I'm visiting a student's family who've invited me. And So I wore the scarf and the long juba, and they told me not to speak English, not to make a spectacle of myself, but they said they will see the American passport, obviously, when you come in. So they were on people I was visiting were on where you get picked up at the Baghdad airport is about a mile or two from the terminal. They don't let cars come into the terminal, understandably. So They said, we'll have a man there, but call us if you have any trouble. And they really did not want me to come in. I mean, I had to get them on the phone with the guards, with the soldiers, to explain. And actually, the young man who I was visiting explained that he said to them, this is a very important woman. And you have to let her in.
Of course.
A very important lady. So they let me in, and I had a very lovely week and went shopping with them. And actually, Hall Spencer, you know, the editor of The Hook, sent me an
I've
email.
Heard of him, yeah,
yeah, he sent me an email and said, stay out of crowded marketplaces because that's where all the trouble seems to be. A bomb exploded in a crowded marketplace. But I went to many crowded marketplaces, and people, it's interesting, in the middle of the terror there, the people are determined to have life as usual. I mean, there's lots of juice bars and ice cream shops, neon, and lots of people out eating and having a night. I mean, of course, it's hot as the hinges. You know, the day I left, it was 129 degrees.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
Really?
And so they stay in all day. Right now, it's Ramadan. So they stay in all day, and then they go out.
Which is a month-long fasting thing.
Right. They fast all day. They get up in the morning.
And eat at night, right?
Right. They get up at 4 and eat a good breakfast, and then they go back until they have to do whatever they do, and then they fast. And fasting isn't just food. They can't have water. They can't smoke. Yeah. They can't put anything in their mouth.
And that's spiritually supposed to put you in touch with those in the
who
are less deserving.
Exactly,
yeah,
right.
To
make you understand what it's like to be hungry, and therefore, presumably, to make you more compassionate.
And more in touch with those who are needy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they and the students who do it, and I've talked to them about it, they do it. School started last year at the end of Ramadan, and they were many of them fasting while we were at school. And they claim that it does have that effect.
So you never felt, we're talking with Rosalind Warfield Brown, who's working at an American university, in northern Iraq in Kurdistan. When you were in Baghdad, visiting Baghdad, you never felt any moment of real trepidation?
Well, there are lots of soldiers. The American soldiers had just left the week before, so I didn't see any American soldiers. It was right after the pullback. And there are checkpoints everywhere. And so the cars, there's not a smooth flow of traffic. You're constantly being stopped or backed up at a checkpoint. And
with Iraqi soldiers.
Iraqi soldiers, yeah. Right. And the protocol when you arrive at a checkpoint is to turn off your lights and turn on your dome lights. So the car is lighted inside and dark out.
Yeah.
And we did that repeatedly driving around the city. But the first night I was there, we had dinner by the Tigris, you know, a restaurant outdoors. And I thought, I read about this when I was 7 years old,
the
Tigris and Euphrates, and here I am.
The cradle of civilization.
Exactly right, Mesopotamia.
That's where it all started.
Yeah, right, here I am having dinner on the banks of the Tigris. I mean, it's really everything that happens is an amazing adventure.
Yeah.
Koi, I'm so glad I went.
So what are the students like in Kurdistan?
The students mostly, we started last year with most of the students obviously were Kurdish because we're not in our permanent campus yet. We have a 400-acre campus that's under construction, and they sort of got the cart before the horse, which I think is typical of over there. They got the thing up and running without any infrastructure, without any facilities, and we're in a rented place, and we have no dorms. So we had Kurdish students who could commute. And then Baghdad told us, I don't know what the impulse was, I don't know whether we'd ask for money or why, but we were told that we, in fact, were not the American University of Iraq, we were the American University of Kurdistan, and we needed to get some diversity in there. So after school had been in session 3 weeks, and I had my faculty, I'm running the English program that's preparing the students to enter the four-year college. And so I had my faculty, we had our classes, and then suddenly we got 75 or 80 new students from Baghdad, from the South, Arabs, and some Turkmen students from Kirkuk. And we didn't have any dorms. We had them living in hotels. We didn't have any classrooms for them. We had to bring in porta cabins, you know, these things they have outside at high schools here. And so now we really do have a much more diverse population. And it's after those students have been there for about 2 weeks, one of the students invited us to there. Many of the students are from little villages outside Sulaymaniyah, really, really sort of primitive little villages. And they students invited me and some of the teachers to go. We got on a bus and some of the Arab students went. And the interesting thing is, Kurdish students speak some Arabic because Arabic is the national language of, you know, the country, but the Arabs speak no Kurdish. There's no reason for them to learn Kurdish when they live in, you know, Babylon or Hilla or Basra. So they're a long way from Kurdistan. So when we were on this bus, one of the teachers turned to me and said, This is the best testimony to democracy in Iraq because these students have to speak English. The Kurds can't speak to the Arab students unless they speak English. That's the middle ground, and we are forging this, comity between these two people, these two groups. And I've remembered that. I mean, to see the students mingling in a way that, that Arabs and Kurds have not. They've been traditional enemies. You know, Saddam hated the Kurds and gassed them in Halabja.
Is that near where you live?
Yeah, it's about 45 minutes away. And, so the Kurds have a lot of resentment about the Arabs, and we see a real camaraderie developing between them in our school. The young people, they don't want to carry on those old hatreds. I mean, the thing about them is that they really are ready to let that go. They really
see the young people in Iraq.
Yes, yeah. And Dr. Barham, who I mentioned, who founded the university, comes often to see them, and he's lionized. I mean, he is a hero in Iraq. And when he comes to the school, the students rush around. They want to have their picture taken with him. And he tells them, you know, we are creating the leaders of the free Iraq. And they believe it. The students have really, there's a video up on the website where they talk to the students about what their goals are. These kids are 18, 19 years old. And one of them looks right in the camera and says, I believe I'll be the vice president of Iraq when I grow up. I mean, one little girl says, I want to work for women's rights and I will be a representative of women in the government. I mean, they have really bought into this belief and they act on it, that the future is theirs to make.
So the seed of democracy, despite some of the things we read in the American press, it was indeed planted in Iraq. If you just go to one place in Kurdistan, at least there you can say, this is one mm-hmm. positive thing of...
Right.
Of what is, you know, arguably a big mess, but
exactly.
Here's one really positive result of the invasion of Iraq.
Yeah.
We do have an American-style university in Kurdistan,
absolutely.
Teaching in English.
And teaching democracy.
And teaching democracy and liberty. And
right. We had a professor from Michigan State came in the spring to teach American history and political science. He had them reading Tocqueville's Democracy in America, and he had them stumbling through because their English is not that good, but he had them reading John Locke's Second Treatise on Government.
Wow!
So,
holy cow!
I mean, you know, as I said, they didn't.
Hey, it worked for Jefferson at William and Mary.
Right. Yeah, I mean, when you said those things, Coy, about, you know, Jefferson's dreams, I mean, that really is Dr. Barham's dream. He wants this to be his legacy to the country, this university. And he's poured all of his money and energy into it. And
what do you hear from the students? We're talking with Rosalind Warfield Brown. I'm curious what you hear from the students when they talk about the situation in Iraq and more like the kind of things that mm-hmm. we see in the news about just the all the bad news and the bombs.
Well, they're sad. I mean, the Kurds are interestingly mixed. I mean, Saddam had an interesting policy, which was called Arabization, where he moved people out. He moved Kurds out forcefully, relocated them out of particularly Kirkuk, where the oil is, and moved Arabs in 25 years ago. And so those people live there now. They think Kirkuk is their town. It's not. It's in Kurdistan, and the Kurds believe it's theirs, and they believe the oil is theirs, and there's huge tension. And so there's the students in Kirkuk, particularly students from Kirkuk, we've had debates about that, and it's that that's a raw nerve. I mean, they're still chafing about that. But and I've read in some of the American press that they do think that Kurdistan could be a flashpoint because of this conflict over the oil, and especially Kirkuk and Mosul, those towns. But the students, they're interesting. They're products of, you know, of a repressed regime for a long time, and their parents certainly are. And so we've had debates. I've sat in on debates in classes where students have argued for example, censorship of the press and said we can't have pornography on TV, we can't have people, you know. And I've also heard some students say we were better off under Saddam, you know, who see that the government is not working, that there's no services, that there's no trash collection.
But they wouldn't have this school under Saddam.
Exactly. Exactly right. Well, we do point that out.
Yeah. And you were telling me earlier when we were speaking that the students are so sheltered by their families that in comparison to Western university students, they're very socially immature.
Well, they are. They're very, in a way, naive. They watch a lot of American TV. They watch a lot of U.S. movies. Some of them try to do rapping. I mean, they they respect and adore, really, American culture. And they all, of course, want to come to America. That's their fondest dream,
really?
To get here. Yes. When I told them I was coming, they all look wistfully and say, wish we could go with you. But, of course, they can't get visas to go anywhere. So it's we did have 8 students come on an exchange student exchange program this summer. There were 4 at UMass and 3 in Arizona and 1 at VCU. And so I can't wait to get back and hear
their stories about what they thought.
So they worship America and they worship American culture, but that at the same time first of all, there's no dating. There's no interaction between the sexes, and you know, boys and girls. There's nothing like dating that we know it. And so at the school, of course, they sit in class with boys and they eat lunch with boys, and there is a lot more mingling than there is in the culture there. But they're very childlike and kind of naive. We went on a picnic. The activity of choice for entertainment. There are no theaters. There's nothing to do. There's one bowling alley. That's it. In the whole city of 1 million people. So what they do for fun is go on picnics. It's a national pastime.
It's so 19th century,
I know,
you know.
I know. And picnic means you take your food with you to a place where there's pretty, you know, trees, which there are none, very few in the whole place. So that's rare to find a place with trees. So they go there by a river usually, or there is a big lake north of us called Lake Dukon. And so you take your picnic and then you hike. You walk around and be in the nature.
Yeah.
And so we were there and the teacher of the American teacher whose class it was showing them how to skip rocks, and they had never seen that before. And so it was, look at me, Mr. J, look at me, look at me. And he said, this is like 6th graders. It was like
they're students.
Yeah, they're 25, some of them 25. But this kind of wonder at the world of these kind of natural things that we take for granted that's all new to them.
Yeah. What's the food like?
Food is very boring, if I do say. It's very monotonous there.
And I'm assuming there's no American fast food. There's no McDonald's anywhere. Anything.
Well, there tries to be. I mean, they do have what they think of, but it's called, Kentucky. And that means a piece of fried chicken, but not fried. And not an identifiable piece. It's nothing you would know as a piece of chicken. It's not anything you can name, but they call it Kentucky. And that's how it is on the menu. It's called Kentucky.
And it means fried chicken.
It means fried chicken, right. And and so you can get that, and you can get hamburgers. Of course, beef. There's no pork in all of the country because of the Islam. But the food is beef, goat, or lamb. In a kebab, which we think of kebab as chunks of meat on a skewer, but their kebab is flat ground meat pressed flat on like a butter knife, a long paddle, and then served flat. So it looks like a ruler of meat on your plate. Or tikka, which we think of as kebab, is chunks of meat on a skewer they call tikka. So you can get that or that. And they're always rotisserie chickens twirling around, you know, on a spit.
Yeah.
So you can get that. And that's about it. There. Sometimes you can get in a very fancy restaurant. You can get fish from Lake Dukon, but it's carp. And
so you tired of the food pretty quickly, I would imagine.
The wonderful thing about the food is the yogurt, and I'm a fan of yogurt anyway. But the yogurt is brought in from the countryside in buckets with grass on the top to keep it cool. So there are mats of grass on the top of the yogurt, and you peel that off, and it's the best yogurt you'll ever eat in your life. It's richer than ice cream. It's just wonderful.
Rosalind Warfield Brown is a faculty member at the American University in Kurdistan, and the website is AUIS.org, and you're headed back to Northern Iraq.
Okay.
Well, we'll touch base with you when you get back. Roz, have a safe trip.
Thanks so much for having me.
There and a safe trip home.
Thank you, darling.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit seavillepodcast.com for more.